am delighted that you have found the Mindset Mental Meets podcast. I'm Angela Cox, your host and indeed the Mindset Mentor, and I'll be interviewing executives and founders at the top of their game to find out what lies beneath. I want to know what makes people proud, how they define success, what holds them back, and indeed what drives them forward. This is authentic and natural conversation with the best in the business. So listen in, enjoy, and if you love what you hear, please do leave a review. And now, over to today's guest. My wonderful guest on the podcast today is Tim Davis, and he's the CEO of Evolve Group, and we'll learn more about what Evolve Group does as we go in the pod, I'm sure. But he's also had a number of senior and executive roles in organizations such as Co-op Health, Well Pharmacy, and Assura Group. He's superhuman, and that's what I love about him. I haven't known him very long, but I can really feel that he values authenticity as much as I do. And he's a fellow Northerner. So he's sitting in front of me now on Zoom. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. How are you feeling today?
I'm slightly nervous after that build-up, to be honest with you. I mean, how do you make sure that you sound really normal and human? I'm not sure. I'll give it a go. No, I'm good. I'm good, thank you.
Oh, I'm glad you're good. Honestly, you're as human as they come, so you don't have to put on any airs and graces. It's just going to come. And you've got the sun shining down on your face today, and it's Friday morning. So yeah, life is good. All is good in the world.
Life is good in the north, yeah. I'm in Manchester. You're not anymore, are you?
No.
You come from around these parts. It doesn't live up to its reputation as being rainy all the time. It's not today anyway.
No, literally, you have the sun beaming down on your face. It's lovely to see. And we're going to be having a good conversation today, Tim, about your proudest moments. And it's something that people usually tell me is a difficult one to answer. And I know that you've felt that as well these last few weeks while you've been contemplating. So I'm really keen to hear what you've got for me on the list, because today it's all about you and all of the things that have happened to you along the way. So let's kick off with your first one. What are you proud of, Tim Davis?
Well, I think I've sort of extended the definition of moment, because I think into something that's slightly bigger than a moment. But I can pinpoint one actually point where this did sort of hit home to me. But my first one is when I realized, and it was a sort of gradual realization, that failure or having failed wasn't a weakness. And there wasn't a sort of lightning strike, and it probably happened over a period of time. But I realized that actually sort of being more open about one's failures or the challenges that have happened over your career or over your life, rather than being something you need to hide and sort of push down, is something that if you have the confidence and courage, and it does take some to be a bit more open about, is something that actually can connect you to people and actually takes a lot of anxiety away from you as well. So yeah, that is, I know it's sort of slightly vague, but I can tell you a quick story about.
Please when, do.
This is just one moment where it sort of hit home to me. And you mentioned that I used to be at the Co-op. Co-op have a thing, like lots of big organizations do, of something called Leaders Unplugged. And Leaders Unplugged was sort of part of a leadership program for people. And it's just one part of it. And they used to get sort of execs and senior leaders to just go to a session. People could book onto your session. And then it was basically up to you as to what you did in that. Mm-hmm. And I've been to a few of these things in various companies over my time. And it typically sounds like a senior leader with getting their CV out with a bunch of logos on the slide and saying, hey, you know what, I did this, and then I kind of did this, and then somebody saw how great I was and I got promoted and I did that. And I thought, how can I have a bit of a take on that? So long story short, I did that. And then I call that above the line, above the top of the iceberg. This is what people see, the logos, the different roles, etc. And then I did a below the sort of iceberg, which is what was really sort of events that were really happening. Things like anxiety attacks. Things like losing your job, getting sacked, right? And just spent 20 minutes talking to people in the room. And this was all sorts of people around that. And I have never, in all the sessions I've done where on various things, I've never had feedback or interest like that. People writing to me to say, basically, thank you. You've sort of done, demystification, and I thought it was just me. So that was a moment, but it's obviously much wider, goes much, much wider than that.
But you're absolutely right in terms of that becoming the hook for connection with people, because when you can demonstrate that you're the swimming swan as well, that you've got all this stuff going on underneath, it does allow people to think, oh, thank goodness for that, I'm a human too. And especially around things like this imposter phenomenon people talk about, because people genuinely believe they're the only person that's sitting around the board table or around the team leader table or whatever it might be that is feeling that feeling. And the reality is we all feel it to a greater or a lesser extent. And the sharing of it makes us feel more human.
Yeah. And I think there's another thing that I've noticed, which is that the more senior you look, the more it exists.
Yeah.
It's sort of inversely proportional, because you might also think, well, it's me. But actually, once you get, if you have to be really senior, then you don't have it. But perversely, probably the most senior people that I've ever had connection with are the people who are the most insecure in that way.
Yeah.
Which is really an interesting phenomenon. You sort of don't grow out of it, or it's not something that is a glass ceiling that is, you know, once you've, if you've got it, then you can only get so far, you know. It really is sort of completely, I think it's probably, if you do a graph, it's probably directly proportional to the seniority of the individual. Because of course, there's a positive side to it, which is for all of the pain of what we might like call imposter syndrome, you know, or I'm not good enough, I'm going to get found out. It's also that thing that sort of drives you along, feeling like you've got to keep on pushing.
Yeah.
Then turns you into a high performer a lot of the time, which then it means somebody notices you, you know. So I'm not saying it's not painful, because I think it is, but there is, like most of these challenges, they are things that are positive. Most things are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, really. There's always the upside as well. And I guess the more senior you get, and you've got that credential of being the CEO or the chairman or whatever it is that you've been striving for, and when you find yourself there, you've still got the feeling, but you're also alone.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reports we get from that kind of C-suite level, is how lonely it is at the top, because you then feel like you can't share it anymore because you've made it to the top and it's not allowed.
Yeah. And I think that you've got to share it. I mean, without wanting to dismiss everything I've just said, there is a really fine line between being so overly open that you actually discredit yourself.
Yeah.
And being vulnerable enough and sort of human enough or grounded enough to make people feel relatable to you, and that you also are not perfect, and you've had, you know, you don't have to have had been perfect to get to that position. So I think that that's, and probably maybe the more senior you are, or the more, you know, certainly in CEO roles where you sort of end up being a figurehead as much as anything else, you have to manage that with care. But for sure, I think the more people who are, and it's definitely, I think culturally we're going this way anyway, but the more people who are open about their flaws, where things have gone wrong, where they've had, I mean, this, I call it like failure with a small f and failure with a big f, you know. And failure with a small f is, you know, something got cocked up, whereas like failure with a big f is somebody sacked me. And those big ones are the ones that really matter in some ways, because, you know, you've got to be careful. You don't play act it. Give people a few little tiny failures, which people go think, you know what, okay, those were daily cock-ups, but were they really life-changing events, you know?
Yes.
So I think it made a big difference to me, and it sort of definitely has changed the way that I lead. I've always been quite open anyway, but I think that the more you look at it, better performance comes out of psychological safety, and creating that environment means being really open, transparent, vulnerable, and sort of admitting errors and admitting flaws, you know. So it's made a big impact on me, for sure.
I'm interested to just touch on how it's changed your view of failure and how you personalize that now that you can be open about the failure rather than trying to keep it covered. Because I feel like when we're open about failure, we're almost more accepting of it, so it doesn't hurt us in the same way as it did when we were using that perfectionist driver to keep everything safe on the top. So what's that done for you, that decision to be more open?
Well, full disclosure, you know, in a funny way, you know, I haven't yet got to a place where if I have a big failure, let's say, you know, something big happens tomorrow, I can't say, oh, well, I'll handle that great because I'm
good. You're a human.
I just know I won't. I'm pretty sure that I've had the lowest of low moments in my life. And as I always say, I suspect I'll go there again. Today isn't the day. I'm always wary of not having sort of fixed this. I just think there's living with as opposed to fixing is important, or being having awareness over it. That said, I do think that you only really learn when things are bad.
Yeah.
You know, of course you do some learning and some developing when things are all right and things are going okay, right? But it's tiny in comparison to when things are tough or you're out of your depth or things are going wrong or something's failed. That is where the real development happens. Mm. So without it, we really aren't developing. That's the truth. So in some ways, appointing people or putting people in roles that are too big for them is a good thing to do. You know, if you've got the space and time to do it, making sure your kids are, not that I'm a parenting advisor, right? But it may are exposed to, you know, failure and things that are tough, and that we, you know, I'm always worried that maybe we're trying to create these days a sort of environment where we protect kids so much that they then aren't equipped
resilient
for real life, you know, where you're going to go into a job and things are going to go wrong straight away and you haven't got much to build on. So I think there's quite a lot of learning from it. So, you know, we as humans, I suppose, in some ways, we're trying to get people to avoid being hurt. And so therefore, it's like inbuilt to try and stop stuff happening. But, you know, when you take the bigger picture, I do think it's around not trying to micromanage every situation so that failure can't occur.
Love that. I love that. And I love how refreshing it is to hear someone who's talking about this acceptance that failure is going to happen and willing to share it. Is also saying it still hurts when it happens, it still impacts when it happens, but what we need to be adept at doing is being able to close the gap between it happens, I feel the pain of it happen, and how long I allow that to impact me for. And if we're still thinking about it 6 months later, that's not a great thing. But actually, if we can feel the pain, learn the lessons, and start to incorporate those lessons moving on, then that's where we get the win.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And, you know, things are it's traumas. And because, you know, we're talking about failure as a nebulous subject, but some of these things that really hurt, they're actually trauma, and they sort of stay with you, don't they, over time? It's about having to deal with that trauma and realizing or rationalizing, which is not easy.
And neutralizing.
Yeah, it doesn't define you. So I think I'd be the first to say that's so easy to say.
Oh, isn't it, Josh? Yeah.
Yeah, like easy to say.
Not as easy to live it.
When you're outside it, you can see it. But I'd be the first to say that I know it's like it's not easy to do when you're in it. So,
which is why it's a proud realization rather than moment. It's like one of those defining realizations in your life that you're now working to change, which is really inspirational, actually. I think that's the first one we've had a proud moment around that. So thank you for sharing.
Great.
What have we got next then?
The second one is a bit more traditional, which is changing sector and becoming the CEO for the first time. So when in 2021, I started Evolve as CEO, I started Evolve as CEO in a sector that I'd never worked in before.
As you do.
I mean, I kind of wanted to change sector because I thought, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And in fairness, most of my life has been in pharmacy and I moved into social care, and there are a lot of parallels, actually, even more differences than there are parallels. So I didn't come into it completely cold. There was a regulated environment and various other things, but at the same time, there was a lot to learn. And actually, 3 years in now, I'm still doing that learning for sure. It was a big step. I haven't been somebody who has always been like, I want to be a CEO, I want to be a CEO. People used to say to me, oh, you should be a CEO. And I think, well, do you know what? I've never really thought like that. I've always just kind of fell into the next thing, really. You know, it's just probably if I had my time again, I would be more deliberate about it, if I'm honest. You know, I didn't. I wasn't deliberate about it. So it just sort of happened. Anyway, I did that and we've done a lot. We've rebranded the company. We've integrated a bunch of businesses that weren't. And I've had to grow a new team, really, or develop a new team, or that's sort of the sort of pride element of it. I think if you look at it, I've been here nearly 3 years. I've tried to bring the style that we've just been describing into a new organization and build a whole new team at the same time. And I'm not going to be as arrogant as to say change a culture, right? But try to start to develop a new culture, because that is, you know, I don't think you ever do. Like, there's no day where you work out, we fix the culture now, so let's move on to the next thing. But we've definitely tried to deliver a company that does things in a certain way and behaves in a certain way and has got some values that we live by. So that's my second one. I tend to lead with a coaching style. I think that means a lot of feedback. That means I tend to spend a lot of meetings talking about how things get done and how people, what's getting in the way, as opposed to, you know, the more traditional technical stuff. I do that, obviously, but, and I think it's been fairly successful. It's been really hard work, but fairly successful. And, you know, in terms of pride, and here I am at 50, I turned 50 this year, still sort of delivering things that I would say, you know, is up there in terms of my most proud moments. Luckily, they're not all behind me.
I love that. And it's, I mean, I'm not going to underestimate how difficult what you've just described is, because there's so many change curves going on there. You know, new role, new organization, new sector. The new sector part, I remember doing that, moving from financial services into food service. I mean, oh my goodness, the two things couldn't be more different. And the learning curve is astonishing. So you've had that learning curve of new sector while trying to establish yourself in the CEO position, and bring a different leadership stance, really, a different culture to an organization that is probably not working in that way traditionally. Yeah. So huge amounts of change. How did you manage yourself as you went through the change curves?
That's a good question. I tried not to put too much pressure on myself to deliver too quickly. And that, again, is one of these things that's easy to say and hard to do. And I'm quite action oriented. So I'd like to kind of get stuff done, and I'm quite sort of deliberate about it. So that's, I have to put the brake on a little bit to try and think, I can see the problems here. Let's crack on and do it. But it's going, slowing down to go a bit faster, to use it kind of phrase. There was definitely an element of that. There's a lot of listening, and listening without necessarily then judging, and trying to understand not just what is different in that sector, you know, what are the things, it's also the culture and the ways of working and the ways of thinking as well, which are in some ways subtly different, but in some ways they're quite different. One of the areas with care is at care and commercial, and I experienced this in pharmacy as well. Those, they're not easy bedfellows because, well, there's a number of different reasons, but we sort of associate caring for somebody as saving money as well.
Yeah.
And I can kind of get it when you look at the whole person or the whole system, that sometimes you think, you know, we have to make commercial sense to be a thriving organization, and we want to give the greatest quality care, and those two things need to coexist.
Yes.
And one can't win over the other, right? We can't just say, look, it's all about quality, then we don't have to worry about commercials. It's just, right, that, I'd love to think like that,
but you can't.
I mean, it wouldn't last very long if that's the way you thought about it. So those things coexisting, and using the right language as well that doesn't grate with individuals or grate with people, is really important, because I think that there are various ways of saying any one thing, and making sure that you can explain the need to be commercially sensible in a way that doesn't make it sound like you're sort of, what's the,
you're
right,
careless
word? So it's really important. And as I say, that was true in the pharmacy sector as well, but even much more acute. The other thing I noticed was that in our business, I think there was a bit of trauma from various things, right? Remember, I came in on the back end of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah,
that was really, really tough for people in this sector specifically. We've got a workforce, what was called a crisis. I think it's slightly less of a crisis now, certainly in our organization, where there weren't enough people to do the work. And then we've had acquisitions, and acquisitions traumatize people as well. New owners, new expectations, things that were familiar are gone, and you're bringing organizations together. So added together, there's a bit of sort of organizational trauma where people are like living on cortisol. There was definitely a need to reassure and be calm. Let's be calm and try and take people out of that sort of trauma phase, if you like, as well.
And there's a real lesson listening to you that other people can take from this if they're in a time of transition, particularly into a new role, because often it's about wanting to make your mark, wanting to be recognized, wanting to be seen as being viable and credible in this job. But actually, your point before around just slow down and go slow to speed up. It's almost like the keep your powder dry moment for the first few months, where you can just really understand how the organization works. So it's been good to hear you say that.
And contract with your boss and your peers. So I think that's an important thing. There's a sense that I've got to come in and I'm going to hit the ground running and I'm going to do these things. And we don't help it because we sort of, but there's a tendency to ask people to do 90-day plans in presence. Yeah. Before they start, you know, what are you going to do in your first 30 days before you've even been in the organization?
Yeah.
Know anything about it. We ask people this. And so the setting conditions in some ways aren't helpful, are they? But I think it's, you know, I certainly say, to people, like, let's just agree what you're going to do in the first 3 months, right? And I spend a lot of time saying, I'm going to be telling you to slow down because I want you to learn, understand, and not burn bridges. Because, you know, the other thing is when you come into an organization, you can burn your bridges quite quickly if you do things, say things, change things, you then subsequently realize are the wrong things.
Yeah, agree.
You know, you've upset relationships and it's hard to recover from.
Yeah.
So I think as a leader, not just a CEO, you know, any leader bringing anyone to an organization, it's important if those are the conditions, not always like that, but if those are the conditions, to sort of contract with the person as well and say, you know, let's just agree that this is what I don't expect of you. If you like, you know, so take the pressure off.
Yeah.
A lot of people put more pressure on themselves than ever you could put on
them. My God, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes the job of the leader in that situation is actually not putting more pressure on, it's taking the pressure off, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's important.
And I guess in the role of CEO, you've got to be the person that does that for yourself, which is your ability to go slow and step back and coach yourself through all of those things you've just talked about.
Yes, true. And often you're working for investors and, you know, I am. And investors aren't necessarily interested in that. So,
slow, no, you know? Show me the money.
Yeah, they may not. They might understand it theoretically, but they don't really want to say to you, yes, go slow for a bit, please.
Yes.
So I think it is important and to sort of self-manage that.
Yeah, definitely.
As well. And I can understand it. There's a pressure coming on. Somebody's hired you. You know, you need to demonstrate you're as good as you said in that presentation and all the rest of it. But there are ways of doing that which aren't necessarily changing at the same time. So
I love that. So we've had sort of this embracing failure and getting used to being open and sharing that vulnerability. We've had your role as CEO in the change of sector, change of organization, change of role. So what have we got as our final one then?
Well, this is going to disappoint you somewhat, I think.
No, I'm never disappointed.
No, so I'm speaking to you from my static caravan.
That is so glamorous, your caravan.
Or my studio. It's my studio, if I like to call it. Yeah, so, you know, we're doing some renovations at the moment. We have been for a year in this house. And about a year ago, I thought, hey, I've got a great idea. I'm going to buy a static caravan and put it down and we're going to live in this.
Oh, my God.
While we do it. So my third one is a sort of metaphor, really, is that when I first got this van, I ripped it to shreds and did a load of what is it, I think we call DIY, and put it back together again, all on the inside. So took the kitchen out, took the bathroom out, changed everything. I wasn't intending to do that. I was intending to buy a cheap caravan and live in it, and then we were going to get rid of it. But it got here, and then I sort of started, and I couldn't stop. One of the things that often gets said about me is like, no half measures, right? And I just don't do half measures very well. So once I've started it, so I am proud. I mean, I am so proud of this van. We are going to have to get rid of it. But the point really is, this is my release. And DIY for me, and it's not just the doing it bit, as in the hammer in the hand and the nail, it's all of the, I'm Screwfix's best customer. They love me. Seriously, they actually know me by my
They see you coming.
Yeah. So we're on first name terms.
I love it.
Which, and I think that for me, it's a release is one word for it, but I'm able to think whilst, when you're doing something that is so consuming, that you are able to do anything else at the same time, you just focused on it. It isn't half amazing for getting your brain to calm down,
mindful,
and decompress. Mm. And I find that after I've done a day or did a day, I spent like 3 months doing this van, running up and down the country, buying things off Facebook Marketplace to put in and all that kind of thing, that my thinking was better after I can step down for a couple of hours in the evening doing it, or a weekend or whatever it might be. So that's the first point. And the second point is, there's something around the investment in time that you put in something that makes you value it. So this is my baby, but I don't think it'd be my baby if I bought it this way.
Yes.
It's the care and effort and the sweat that I put into it to make it that way. So I'm not sure whether there are any business learnings from this. You might be able to squeeze a drop out of it.
I'm just thinking there's a personal learning in there for me, because I had a conversation with my husband on the weekend and he said, we're looking at these houses. Let's find one that we can renovate, because we'll get more for our money if we do that. And I was like, no, let's find one that's like all completely done, so I have no stress when I'm moving.
Yeah.
And now I'm listening to you going, well, maybe I've got it wrong.
Well, you might, you know, you might do. I mean, there's definitely a thing around, I mean, and again, I mean, not wanting to sort of wax lyrical about society these days, the sort of disposable nature of everything and the fact that everything is sort of immediately available, I think tends to devalue things.
Yeah. That dopamine hit is like, yes,
yeah. Just... And so, but when, you know, if you, I can remember as a kid when I had to go to work for weeks on end, I used to work cleaning fridges out in Marks and Spencer's on the Sunday, before Sunday trading was a thing, it was shut. And then they used to get us in there. We had to, God, it was an awful, awful job of having to take the fridge shelves out and spray them down. It was really hard going. And I worked every weekend in order to buy this like tennis racket, which I'd seen. And I like really wanted this tennis racket. And I can still remember the feeling now.
Oh.
Of going in the shop and buying the tennis racket, you know, just like the unbelievable nature that I am actually about to purchase this racket. And I just think about that. I mean, if I'd just been able to order off Amazon and press a button and get it in, pretty sure
there's
I wouldn't.
There's no value. Yeah.
40 years later, you know.
Yeah.
So, or 30 years later. So there's definitely that. But yeah, there's both the distraction when you've got these type of roles. It's important to have some balance. Mm. And then, which I think is well understood, you know, and everyone's got their own way of doing that, but also the effort and
versus reward. Yeah. I love that. And have you got those hands that, like, I was deadlifting the other day and I was saying to the guy, oh, my hands are killing me trying to lift this deadlift thing. Yeah. And he was like, oh, you need to go and do some DIY, Ange, because that'll sort your hands out. You'll be able to do it. And I'm like, maybe. Have you got like DIY hands?
No, but in fact, it used to be a joke that for my friends, one of my friends runs a wood yard and the other one runs a haulage company. Some of my best friends. And they used to literally take the mick out of me for having the most beautiful hands compared to their hands. I mean, they're not, you can see my hands. They're
manicured them.
They're not particularly beautiful, but they definitely don't say, look, this guy's been doing physical work all his life. Like theirs do, you know. So, you know, they said, look at his hands. He definitely works in an office. So, no, I haven't quite got to that stage.
Not yet.
I mean, that's an ambition of mine.
That's retirement for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just think it's amazing that you've spent a year in a caravan and you're still married and your kids still like you. I think that's a miracle.
Well, you haven't asked, you know, you're assuming about the like me.
I mean, we were in like one of these lodges over the weekend, a couple of weekends ago, eight of us, because we've got four kids. I mean, you're just on top of each other. I couldn't cope. I was like, what is this about? I think you're a miracle worker.
No, well, we are ready to kind of get out of here now, I have to say. But it's been like, it's interesting. You see I've got a newfound respect for these people on Grand Designs, you know. Not that we're doing a Grand Design, but then Kevin MacLeod's sort of disappointed face.
I just love his face.
With it, yeah, and the colours drained out of the faces of the
film. Yeah. Oh, I love that programme. I watched that with my daughter, and my daughter says, Mum, he's traumatising these people, the way that he speaks to them. I said, well, this is like leadership in most organisations. Obviously not in Evolve, because you're a forward-thinking leader, which is what we love. Oh, do you know what? I mean, this is just like a natural conversation. I'm loving this. So we've had three really different types of proud moments or proud thoughts. So I'm keen now to talk to you about what you believe the secret to success is. Yeah. And this is from your perspective. So it's always different on every podcast. What would you say?
It's really hard to nail it in one thing. I mean, I think there's a sort of, if I was to name it, it's like try to lose perfection.
Uh-huh.
So I think perfection gets in the way, or perfectionism gets in the way of a lot of things. And I'm a sort of recovering perfectionist.
Mm-hmm, me too.
And that's not to say, and I'm really keen to say that's not to say I was perfect at anything, because I wasn't. But as far as perfectionism is concerned, I think I sort of had really high standards, and some of that from the way I was brought up and all the rest of it, you know, and trying to sort of please people and all of that, you know. So I think perfectionism gets you so far, and I think it is a, to some extent, it is a strength, because you meet people who've got high standards. They put lots of pressure on themselves. They want to deliver to things, and that's great. But when it tips over, and often it does, I think it really is an inhibitor. So I think part of that is we can get obsessed with as leaders with the content of what we say. And again, this could potentially sound a little bit cliched, but it really isn't what you say. It really is how you make people feel. If you think about any great interaction that you ever had, or a leader that you respected, or somebody you work for, whatever, a lot of it will have been how they made you feel.
Yeah.
And a situation, because often I used to have this kind of obsessive fear of presentation. I still have got it, really, in a way, and but I've kind of learned to live with it. And this is somebody once said to me that more people are afraid of public speaking than they are of death.
Apparently. I can imagine that.
This is in a bizarre sort of way. That's true. And so public speaking, kind of standing on stage, and then this thing about the bigger the audience, the more difficult it might seem. And then the idea that you're going to sort of try and perfect everything. A lot of folk, including me, and I have to sort of talk myself out of it every time, try to think, right, I am going to pair. I'm going to perfect it. I'm not going to get a word wrong. I'm not going to forget anything. And I'm going to deliver it.
You're a robot,
and then tick, you know, that will be great. Of course. But if you watch anybody, you don't think like that, do you? You think, how did that person make me feel? And actually, the more imperfect it is, as long as it's above a level of completely imperfect, right?
As long as it's competent.
Yeah. And the more ums and ahs and thought and sort of off script and human, the more you're engaged, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so that certainly I feel that way. And so I think losing perfection, even on I've just talked about what I would call a big stage there, but even in the small stages.
Yeah, even to one-on-one.
One-on-one is, and I suppose on a one-on-one, it's around not feeling that you have to have any answers, not feeling that you have to have an agenda, you know, admitting you don't know something, saying, you know what, I'm lost here. How are we going to work this out then? I don't know. Those kind of vulnerabilities, you might call them, I think really are what's required in most jobs, not all, for sure. There are some technical roles where actually it's all about IQ, and you know what, EQ, you have to have enough, you know, the more IQ you've got, the better you're gonna be at your job, right?
Yeah.
So those roles at a senior level, few and far between.
Yeah.
Most are, you have to have enough IQ to be competent. Beyond that, more and more and more IQ does not equal more and more and more performance.
Yeah.
But EQ is where it's about. And so I think, even though we've been talking about this conversation for, well, a good 25 years now, probably, maybe slightly longer, I still don't think it's necessarily landed.
No, I agree.
In most organizations.
I agree. I'm thinking back to my time in organizations and getting up on stages and doing that perfectionist thing, and the fear that I used to feel in terms of, I must get this right, and then I'd perform like a robot. It would be word perfect, but the cost to me was enormous. And it didn't land with people, because now what happens is, I mean, I've not got a boss anymore, so it's great. I do whatever I want, but I rock up without any fear because I'm not answerable to anyone. I'm just me with my accent that I've got. I don't put on the posh accent that I used to try and do before. And I don't drink red wine anymore because I hate it, but I used to. And I'm just me. And what happens is, I mean, you know, I'm fluffing my words all over the place, going off on tangents. But at the end, the people are coming over.
Yeah.
And there's the connection. And that's the difference between the two versions of me, the one that had to have it perfect because what would people think? And, you know, that's what I'm expected to do, versus now I don't really care what other people think to the same extent that I used to. Still do a bit.
You're right to care. I mean, I think that's totally right. I think, you know, you've got to care. You know, it's good to care.
Yeah.
But if you're finding yourself thinking about a presentation, let's make it a presentation. If you're thinking about it a month before, and you're preparing a month before, you are doing so much harm to yourself, and all in the goal of trying to make it better and trying to improve it, but actually probably won't.
Yeah.
That said, and I think it's really important to make this point because just to balance a bit, I've witnessed very senior leaders who think they've gone past the point of needing to do any preparation. And that is a huge mistake, because I think people who land the best have done enough prep.
Yeah. You need to care enough, don't you?
You need to care enough. Yeah. You've got a structure and you care enough to know that you want to be coherent. Yeah. And on often, I have observed with certain people, they get so
wing it stage. Yeah.
That they think, hey, I can do this without. And actually, that, you know, you might look relaxed, but you're also completely incoherent. So I don't advise that. I advise, you know, make sure you got your structure, know what you want to say, but don't over prepare everything. Right. And that is, and again, God, it's easy to say, is it? But it's hard to do.
And believe that people want you to succeed and want you to do well, because that self-belief bit is almost like the antidote to the perfectionism that's underpinned by I'm not good enough.
Yes.
So if I can believe that people want the best for me and that I'm good enough, then actually my performance is going to be different to what it would be if I'm on the other side of the fence.
Definitely. I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, it's something that's I think as a society, we still have to work on in terms of giving people permission to do these things and not to feel as though things are perfect. It really is tough, you know, and it's such a, for those of us who have to do it, it's an unusual environment.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think, for me anyway, I don't think it ever becomes normalized. So I think it's always something where you realize needs preparation, needs some level of thought that goes into it, but not so much. And don't be perfect, you know, the getting your head more imperfect equals good, which, you know, you can say it, but people need to believe it.
And for me, imperfect is authentic. If we can be authentic, take the mask off, then life is good. So your secret to success is all about letting go of the need to be perfect.
Yeah.
And becoming a human being.
Yes. Yes, it is. And that's where I think, which is pretty simple when you think of it like that. I mean, it's not exactly going to get written in a book somewhere and written as a tome. But I think that is the more we can be relatable.
Yeah. Love that.
The more grounded. I've got this word normal. I mean, I use it a lot where I'm like, let's just be normal. You know,
human.
Normal's a bad word, isn't it? Because everyone's normal's different. But I think it is that, you know it when you see it. And it calms the atmosphere around people and allows people to say, you know, you can come to work and be yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's a positive thing.
Oh, it's so positive. So we've got let go of perfection, be a human being, which then allows you to actually accept failure a little bit more and learn from it and move forward and grow. And then you can slow down a bit in terms of needing to rate the impression, needing to drive things forward, slow down and think before you start acting. And then when all else fails, what you need to go and do is some DIY to ground yourself, be more mindful, and then you're ready to go through that cycle again.
That's it, pretty much, in a nutshell.
In a 45-minute podcast, that's an amazing cycle of lessons. You could, I mean, you've got all your chapters mapped out there. I love it. Oh, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
For being so open and honest. Have you got DIY planned in the rest of your day?
No.
No DIY today?
Not meant to be working.
Oh, there we are then. So we have to go and do some work before you can pick up the hammer over the weekend. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you for coming on the podcast and have a good rest of your day. And so, just like that, we're at the end of the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed your time listening today. And a big thank you from me for taking the time. I'd really love it if you would be able to leave a review, because it really does help us to get noticed. And if you haven't already, why not subscribe, and then you never miss an episode. I wish you a lovely rest of the day, whatever it is that you're doing, and I hope that you stay safe and well.